Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. Coming up on the programme this week,
my analogy is always the seatbelt analogy. You don't crash your car and then look for your seatbelt.
The barriers have been broken down in terms of the conversation, but other barriers are appearing, or other gateways aren't opening up for those people. And that's an imbalance, isn't it?
When I got angry, because at the core of me, I didn't want to react like my dad, I never showed it, but I cried.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. The home of the UK's conversation about mental health. Welcome back to Mental Health Monday. Thank you to everybody who was fed back on last week's edition, where we were talking about the frankly shocking England and Wales suicide figures for 2023 that were released in September 2024. Paul Vittle, such a great guest, and actually a big focus on that conversation around new ways of thinking about suicide. Now, this week's conversation comes off the back of the Darzi report, which looked at the current state of the NHS. It found surging waiting lists, particularly for children and young people, when it came to mental health support, and also the fact there are 2.8 million people who would normally be looking for work who are currently inactive in the workplace. And the main reason why those people are inactive, the number one reason, was a mental health problem. So this conversation today is going to be about how do we reframe mental health conversations? What are those new ideas, practical ways that we change the conversation on mental health and come up with those practical steps to change society as we know it today? It's a big issue. I've got just the guy for it, because it is a guy who has been with us from almost day one, actually, on Mental Health Monday. He's been a regular contributor and he's a real top fella. Clark Carlisle. He's a former professional footballer. He is someone who has experienced in the past suicidal thoughts and also gambling and drink addictions. He's spoken about that in the past as well, and he's done so openly and in a very genuine way. We're going to talk today about not just his experiences, but how we can change the mental health picture and arrest some of the declines that we're seeing in terms of people's mental health right across the board with practical steps, and also not just forcing people to do it on their own, bringing other people into the mix as well. This week, Clark's been announced as the new Chief Operating Officer of It's Mental, which is an organisation based in the northwest of England, who essentially use the power of the collective to help and support people with their wellness. In the same way that if you moved onto a street and you had fantastic neighbours and he said, have your boiler packs in, you want to speak to number 13. If you need someone to do some painting and decorating, Leslie over at number 17 is the perfect person to go to. Oh, I've got a great number for a milkman. I've got the contact number for a window cleaner if you want one of them as well. That idea of a collective helping and supporting for all different aspects to improve the whole. Wellness is a big talking point. Now, Clark Carlisle, such a top guy. You might notice that the audio quality of this conversation maybe isn't up to our regular high standards. That is because Clark, bless him, was having one of those days when we spoke. He just checked into a hotel in Manchester. He'd been in a car which had broken down. He'd had to abandon the vehicle which had all his kit in it. The car which then came to pick him up broke down. And then he left his phone in the other car which had then picked them up again. So I got a phone call 20 minutes before the conversation, presumably from a phone box, saying, I'll be with you, but I'm going to be a little bit late. So if you do notice that the sound quality isn't the same as it normally would be, I will absolutely forgive Clark, but it was such a good story that he told me about the day that he was having, the day from hell. That's a conversation for another day here at Mental Health Monday. But let's talk about those figures. 2.8 million people inactive and not within workplaces as a result. The number one reason for that, mental health problems. Surging numbers in children and young people suffering with their mental health. It's a problem we're dealing with today in 2024 in the UK. Clark Carlisle is our guest.
They're heartbreaking. They're utterly heartbreaking. The number of suicides, people don't factor in the butterfly effect of that. You know, it's not just that one number. It's not just that one family. There are dozens of lives affected by every one of those numbers. And then it's that will be contributing to people being inactive in work due to poor mental health. You know, nothing is singular in the adverse mental health space. And, well, I mean, how long ago was it that you did the 24 hours mental health thing? Was that like 6 years ago?
Yeah, hey, that's a great memory. Yeah, 2018, the world's longest radio
Yeah.
show. Yeah.
6 years ago, how many times did we reiterate through those 24 hours that, like, basically pending doom? Not that we wanted to be Nostradamus, but we said, and repeated contributors said, if we don't do something now, this pandemic, this mental health pandemic, is going to break our systems. And obviously that was hugely fast forwarded by the COVID pandemic. And off the back of that, again, when the COVID pandemic ended and people had that, they were almost released back into the wild. And Carrie and I mentioned it frequently, the mental health effect of the COVID pandemic. We're not going to see it yet. We're not going to see it immediately. It's going to be 2, 3, 4 years down the line where the emergence of anxiety disorders, of depression, of breakdowns in marriages, the impact on our young people with their brain, the arrested development, both emotionally and socially. And now we are seeing it, mate. So, it's a dark place to start the conversation. However, there is light. There is light because now, the people are honing their attention in on what we can do about it. And for us to get that right, I think there are one or two fundamental aspects that we need to address as a society. Do you want me to tell you them?
Well, that would be a great conversation to have. Let's come on to that one. Hey, but let me ask you this though, and you've done fantastic work in this space, and I'd like to think that I've been a contribution to this wider conversation around mental health. And I've speak to the people who do incredible work, and I have been in rooms where I have been left, speechless by what I've heard and the incredible stories. But then there's a flip side of it is like I've been in those rooms, and then every year when I see the suicide stats or I see the waiting lists for mental health, I see them going up. So there's two things happening, which is that the barriers are being broken down in terms of the conversation, but other barriers are appearing or other gateways aren't opening up for those people. And that's an imbalance, isn't it, in where we're at now, that we can say, we can be quite smug about, oh, look at us, we're talking so openly about mental health and the need for things. But without recognizing that there are, millions of people on waiting lists, young people who are desperate for diagnosis and so on and so forth. Those things have got to go together, haven't they? They've got to be parallel lines. Otherwise, we can be talking about the fact that we've got a big problem, and it's a big problem that we can't necessarily solve on our own.
100%. Carrie and I always had a rule whenever we went and spoke to an organization, we're not going to come into your organization and raise awareness if you don't have resources that are fit for purpose and commensurate with the need when people become aware that they've got something they need to deal with. That was incumbent on us. Now, in the mental health sector, and the way that the awareness drive has gone, and rightly so, the trumpet has been sounded. It's been by the sector in and of itself, as opposed to the health system in its entirety. And the health system in its entirety is funded by government. And government is on its backside. And it doesn't know its priorities from its elbow. And it doesn't know how to distribute the funds that are going to fix this problem. Do you know why? Because no one has the single solution to this problem. Because there is no singular solution to this problem. So if you're looking for a single strand answer and you say, yes, we're going to put all of our fund into, let's say, even crisis services, we're going to put all of our funds into crisis services. Well, all you are doing then is underpinning one aspect of a service that is, it might address suicide statistics. You're underpinning one aspect of a service where people have either gotten to crisis point and acted out, or they've got a sufficient level of awareness where they know, actually, I'm in need, I'm going to go there. But it still hasn't broken down or bridged that gap for those who don't know they don't know. those who do know and don't know where to go, or do know and don't want to go because of stigma, blah, 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 whatever it is, perception. That's a huge disparity. The overarching issue, Mick, is that what we do as a society, I mean, we often talk about, and we know we're a reactive society. So when we talk about mental health and wellness provisions, everything's phrased as, if this happens, then do that. When you're feeling this, then you go there. And even that narrative, which is an awareness narrative, is still a reactive narrative. It's when things are wrong, that's when you take action. And that's why our health systems are so overloaded, because no one is underpinning their wellness. So let me articulate this continuum. There is a distinct difference between someone going from unwell to stable to someone going from stable to well. And that's what crisis services do. They get someone who's actively suicidal, they'll medicate them, they'll give them a diagnosis, and they'll throw them back out on the streets because they're not suicidal anymore. But that person is not well. All you've done is stabilize them. So when life comes on and slaps them in the face, like it does, they go from stable to unstable again. And that's why you see people going in and out and in and out of the system, because our perception is that to be stable is good. It's not. Not being unwell is a totally different thing to being well. That's only one part of this continuum of where we need people to be. And if everything is focused on crisis and disaster recovery services, then nobody will get the support that they need to go from stability to wellness. And the difficulty in that, Mick, again, like we know, we say it all over the place, there are 8.2 billion different ways to be well. So you can't get someone who's stable and say, you must now do this, because that works for me. What works for me doesn't even work for my wife. And we've come on this journey together. You know, and it definitely won't work for you. So once you're stable, it's like you're opened up to this super highway of possibilities. And even if you've got an appetite to get well, it can be so overwhelming. So I'm so passionate about this. I truly am. We need to get people who are stable and who experience, you know, times of wellness or resilience to do more than just be well and resilient. What you have to do is go through that period of self-reflection and analysis to understand, why am I well? Why am I resilient? And let's say, you know, a good friend of mine, they say, I'm well because I play golf every Saturday. And I'm like, brilliant. But why does golf make you well? Because it's not golf in and of itself. So when you look at that and you break it down, and it's like, well, actually, I get 4 hours in nature. I get 5 hours where I turn my phone off. I get a walk and talk with two or three friends. And then I'm able to, at the end of it, have a little bit of camaraderie in the 19th. You know, with half a dozen people, we've had a bit of healthy competition, and I've had some physical activity. I'm like, right, that's why you're well. It's not golf. It's the time in nature. It's the physical activity. It's the human connection. It's the switching your phone off. It's the camaraderie with other people with a bit of healthy competition afterwards. Now that you know that, if there's a pandemic and golf is taken away, you're not floundering, because it's not golf that makes you well. You know there are 6 things that make you well. Right, I need 4 hours in nature. I need to walk and talk with someone. I need to turn my phone off for 4 hours a week or a day. And that's how you underpin your wellness.
One of the interesting things that I'm spotting more and more, because often we'll talk about age groups, so we'll say men over the age of X, or like young people under the age of 14 or whatever it is. But what you've just described there, it's important to talk about transitions as well, isn't it? Because you can have a plan, or you can have a state of wellness as a 14 or a 15 or a 16-year-old who, you know, mum or dad looks after the income, you know, there's the bed's always made, and you know, I'm well, yeah, I'm fine, I do what I kind of do. You get into a workplace, your boss goes, right, pick up the phone, ring these people, get out into the world, start paying your rent. Suddenly, all of those, the things that you thought were like part of your wellness state, are suddenly stripped away. And it's like, well, what have you got in that place? If your mate who plays golf suddenly goes, golf, you know, is banned from the golf club, they suddenly can't play golf anymore. Mm-hmm. Or you are living well and you are up to the age of 40, 50, and you hit, and your wellness state is your family and all that, and then suddenly you get divorced and you lose your job. The transition from one state to the next state can be often throw up those trigger points, those flashpoints that throw up those negative mental health experiences. And that's why that idea of having the education and knowing what those things are, you can then apply them and say, okay, situations change, but I know this core of what, yes, I can do. That's really important, isn't it? But that's, you've got to take a deep dive, or you've got to be, have your hand held through that learning process, haven't you, to know what, yes, those core things are. Because, I mean, it's, to me, it's no surprise that men over the age of 50 are taking their lives, when that's also the age that marriages are breaking down, they're losing the job that they've had, the kids have left home, their life has completely changed after 50 years of it being on a steady sudden pathway. Of course, at that point, they feel absolute despair, no hope for the future, uncertainty, anxiety, and everything. I can completely understand that. But it's about, how do we engage people through those transitions, or how do we help people so that when they hit those moments, which you're allowed to feel are terrible, you're allowed to feel are devastating and are hugely, you know, upsetting. But it's like, but what does the next 3 years look like? What does the next 3 months look like? That core, that understanding has got to be there. And, you know, it's a big man who learns that at the age of 50, but somebody who learns that when they're 11, 12, 13, or learns it as part of a workplace introduction, or has ongoing learning processes, that's a very different story, isn't it? And that's a much easier process to engage with.
It's a much easier process to engage with. You know, when you're trying to support someone to wellness who is in crisis or in trauma, it's an elongated journey. It's an elongated journey because invariably what you have to do is unlearn what you knew, introduce new ideas, practice those new ideas, become proficient at them, and then achieve wellness. If you can get someone who's a young person the likelihood is that they don't actually know their core values yet. They don't know their core identity yet. So if you can get someone who is fresh-faced and does have an appetite to learn that, and like you said, guide them along that process of understanding, well, I speak to those people because they resonate with me here. I like to do this because it fits my value of A, B, or C. Yeah, bring that into a situation, Clark. That person who does lose their job at 50 years of age, and it utterly destroys them, you know, invariably it's because their core value is in a position of provider, or their core value is in holding a title or a position of esteem. That's where their identity is linked. And when you take that away and they feel bereft and they feel lost and dispositioned, and they haven't got the way to process that in a safe and constructive manner, that's when you see the mass deterioration. So my analogy is always the seatbelt analogy. You don't crash your car and then look for your seatbelt. You put your seatbelt on first. And you don't put your seatbelt on because you know you're going to crash your car. You don't put your seatbelt on expecting to crash your car. You do it anyway to mitigate what happens when you're in your car. Equally, you don't crash your car and then think, oh, better get some insurance for this. No, it's too late. It's after the fact. You don't crash your car, look around and say, oh, are you hurt? Are you hurt? You're going to be off work for a while. Yeah, we better get some critical illness cover. You do all these things in advance, not in expectation of trauma, but to mitigate when life and trauma happens. And this is the approach we need to have with our wellness. So pre-transition, when things are well, when you've got a clear and objective perspective of where you are in life, that's when you have to put the things around you that are going to mitigate life's impact. And what I put around me is going to be different to what you put around you, Mick. But just as a classic example, I have a council of people around me. I have a therapist, I have my wife, I have my older brother, I have my parents, my father who sadly passed away, but I still speak to him. And I have my best friend, and I have a man friend. I'll explain the distinction at some point, I'm sure. But I know that if anything happens in my day, I've got someone to speak to about anything. If you just have one person, I mean, my wife is my human. She is the majority of the reason why I'm still alive and the majority of the reason why I am so well today. However, the thing I want to talk about might be about my wife. And that's a very hard conversation to instigate when I've had no objectivity on it. So I might go and share it with my therapist first and be like, I'm getting these emotions, you know, in this situation. I might go and speak to my best friend because I know that they're married and see what they're saying, you know. And that's why I have six people, because if one person's taken away or if it's about one person, I know I've got someone.
Yeah.
Now, what is it that catalyzes me to speak to those people? Now, this is a huge thing for men of our generation and the big suicidal demographic. If my emotions are spiked in a day, for whatever reason, historically, I would compartmentalize it. I just stick it in a box, forget about it. I mean, if we're talking 15 years back and it was a big emotion, I'd go and drink on it. I'd drink at it to escape it or you know, avoid it or whatever. But now, if my emotions are spiked in a day, I note it. And then later, every night, I'll do my daily reflections and I'll come back to these notes. I mean, literally in notes in my phone. And I'll say, I felt really, really sad today at that point. And I asked myself two questions. Was that feeling of sadness, was it appropriate for the situation I was in? And the second question I ask is, well, if it was appropriate, was the depth of it proportionate to what I just experienced? If either of those questions are no, then I know that there was something else feeding that emotional response, not just the situation I was in. And I'll go and talk to someone about it, whoever the relevant person is. And the only way that you can do that is if you have an understanding of your own emotions. You know, I was emotionally illiterate for 37 years of my life. I knew what they were, but I couldn't tell you why I was feeling them, and I was confused about them. For example, anger is an emotion I've never expressed in my life, ever. And the reason why was because, you know, as a young child, my dad used to hit us. You know, we'd get the belt. And the way he displayed anger, I was petrified of. And how I saw that anger displayed, I never wanted me to do that in my life. So as an adult, when I got angry, because at the core of me, I didn't want to react like my dad, I never showed it, but I cried. So I'd be incredibly angry, but instead of raging, I would burst into tears. Now, because I didn't understand my emotions, I thought that the situation made me sad. But it didn't. It was my inability to express anger that came out in tears. And it's only through therapy that I can know and understand that. And now, as a 44-year-old man when I get angry in a day, I still don't display it, but I acknowledge that I'm angry. And it means that I can respond in a situation like a 44-year-old man rather than emotionally react in a situation like an 8-year-old boy. Now, none of that comes by accident, and none of that comes on my own. And people need to hear, when I talk about that unwellness, stability, wellness continuum, I didn't understand this until I was going from stable to wellness. You know, I've been right at the precipice and taking my medication then, getting a diagnosis, doing intense therapy, that stabilized me. But these internal learnings that I've got about my emotions and who I am and my identity and what I need, that came after that. And not with any of these people. It came after that with 3 new therapists who I needed at different junctures, with 2 life coaches, one who specialized in relationships, one who specialized in emotions, with my wife and my family. That's where that knowledge came. So when we talk about helping people and changing the direction of mental health in our society, we have to tell people that being stable is not enough. And getting well, you're not going to do on your own, nor is one person going to take you there. Absolutely. You need to go out and find these people who are going to, you know, help you learn about you, help you put into place these new things. And you have to discover about yourself. You have to try golf and see that it doesn't work. Try cooking, you know, try crocheting. Go and do hot yoga. Whatever it is, try these things and understand what it is that they give you. Because it's the what it gives you that you can find elsewhere and replicate if it's taken away.
And I know even this week, Clark, your new role as Chief Operating Officer at It's Mental, a great organisation, doing fantastic work, particularly in the northwest of England. Actually, they've got a big emphasis in the sort of the collective and the sort of a community and society as well. You hinted as well about what those lessons are. So when you're working, you know, in this new role, nice title by the way, but when you're going into these organisations, and I guess some of these organisations may go, Clark Carlisle's going to do a talk, like. And it's going to be like, oh, I saw him at a sportsman's dinner in 2008. You know, he was good, like whatever it would be. But actually, the ideas that you're talking about here are much more about collectivism, you know, about community, about surrounding yourself with the right people and actually challenging people to go on their own journey as well. So in terms of those solutions that, not solutions that you're offering, but that advice that you're offering within those spaces with like CEOs of big businesses and so on and so forth, Do they engage with that? Do they get what you're saying and actually believe it's something that they can contribute to?
It's a brilliant question, Mick. And what we're finding is that there is a huge disconnect with people's understanding of prevention measures and reactive mental health support. So even when we're talking to HR departments and we're asking their senior personnel, what do you do in a preventative manner? What do you provide for your staff? They say, well, when this happens, we do this. And we're like, well no, you know, you're fundamentally missing the question. Everyone is anchored in that reactive mindset. So it takes examples, et cetera, and analogies to bring them over to this way of thinking. And it's going to take good faith, I suppose, in organizations to engage and trust with a different direction. Now, that different direction, when I said that pathway from stability to wellness, there isn't a single practitioner who can take you the whole way. There isn't one. And if they're saying that, they're lying to you. All they can do is facilitate growth in their area of expertise and speciality. And when we talk about wellness, and you'll see like the pillars of wellness, they cover so many different aspects of our lives. And This is what we are trying to provide with It's Mental. Well, there's no trying. We are providing. We've got a wellbeing collective in Preston, and we're launching one on Friday, 13th of September in Manchester. And we will be launching one in Liverpool soon to be confirmed. And a wellbeing collective is a group of practitioners. And when I say practitioners, people think therapists and stuff like that. No, what I mean is experts in their own field. And not just therapists or counsellors, but we're talking every aspect of life. So we've got financial advisors, we've got will writers, we've got nutritionists, we've got PT instructors, we've got emotional coaches, relation coaches, trauma-informed coaches. So we're covering every possible aspect of what it could constitute for a person to be well. And the difference in this collective is, when you go and see, let's say the physio, for an easy example, when you go and see a physio, because I've got a sore knee, and you have six sessions with the physio, and they fix your knee. But while you're having those sessions, you're chatting because you're doing all this stuff, you identify that, oh, actually, I've got an anxiety issue. And also, you know, my I need help with money, finances and financial management because I can't pay this invoice on time. Well, what currently happens is the physio says, right, I've fixed your knee, and yeah, off you pop, back out into the ocean. You know, you've got these other issues to fix. Whereas with it, if you come to the wellbeing collective, the physio will say, right, we've fixed your knee, and we've identified that, you know, you need help with financial management and also possibly stress and anxiety. So I am going to refer you to person A and person B, and they will address that for you. So the power of the collective, it means that any person going in to access one service isn't just accessing one service. They're accessing a 30-fold collective of practitioners who are going to look after any aspect of their well-being. And the benefit for that for the businesses, for the organizations, is they've got client referral geographically situated of the highest order. And that means that we can provide a pathway for someone from stability to wellness in this collective. And it's all in your area. And it's groundbreaking. And to be a part of the collective, you have to buy into that prevention narrative. You have to see your client pathway as bigger than what I contribute on that pathway. Because if they don't buy into that, then it falls apart. So the collective meet fortnightly. And what they do is they test each other's services. They get to know all the other practitioners. They deliver little showcases to each other so that we develop a trusted group who are all on this prevention drive and know that their expertise is one block in the chain of their client's wellness. And that's going to be powerful.
It's really exciting in terms of an idea, but also the idea that it's a group of people who are watching each other's backs. And then when people join the group, then the group kind of goes, all right, well, I can do this for you, and I can do this. It's like the perfect society, isn't it? You move into a new town. Oh, I'll clean your windows for you. Such a buddy does your gutters. This person, if your boiler pack's in, they'll knock on the door for you as well, which is about society. You feel like you're part of something as well, which is huge as well. We are out of time, and I am so grateful for you speaking to me. I know we could talk for hours.
I had so much to
say.
You're gonna have to get me on again.
No, exactly. We should catch up again. But it's always great to catch up with you just to find out about what you're doing, the incredible work you're doing in this space as well. Good luck with the new role as well. I know that things are rolling out across, particularly the northwest of England, but further afield as well. And there are big plans for that too. But thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate you speaking to us once again on Mental Health Monday.
Great to see you, mate.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.